Yeah, I would like to thank Rob Myers for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. Secondly, I'd like to mention that this work was developed in collaboration with Gary Horowitz and David Tong, and it's based on two papers, one of which is already out in the archive, and the other one should be out soon. So I'm here today to tell you about holographic lattices. Okay, what is this? This is basically a gravitational crystal. So what we did was to construct an holographic dual of a normal lattice in a conformal field theory, okay? So what is the motivation and the framework? Well, obviously, the framework is the ADS-CFT correspondence, which maps solutions of Einstein's equations with a negative cosmological constant into states of the CFT, okay? This is a very useful correspondence because it's a strong weak correspondence. By doing classical gravity on the ADS side, we hope that we can understand some universal properties about strongly coupled conformal field theories. Good. One particular aspect about this conformal coupled field theories pertains to the study of condensed matter, the world of many bodies, and this supposedly is incorporated inside Einstein's gravity. So one can hope to use Einstein's gravity and to learn something about condensed matter physics. Indeed, there has been a lot of work in this area. So there has many interesting phenomena have found their gravitational dual. This list is you know, could be extended a lot more. This is some of the interesting work, in my opinion. We have found a gravitational dual of a superconductor, of a superfluid. We think we understand more or less what the Fermi surface is in this context. We have built a Josephson junction using gravity. We have studied finite size superconductors. We can see what impurities are. You know, this list could go on and on and on. Now, all of these examples have one thing in common. They reproduce well-known effects of standard condensed matter physics. In fact, they aim to do that. Okay? What we want to do with this is to convince the community that holographic methods do work. For instance, the Josephson effect is not obvious at all that should come out from gravity. Okay? It just so happens that it does. So we want to go a little bit beyond this and see whether holographic methods can provide a new insight into some open questions in condensed matter physics, okay? Now, one of the key points that condensed matter physicists tell us is that we have no lattice anywhere, which is a, you know, if you're doing solid state physics 101, that's the first thing you do, you have a lattice. And so far, this has not been achieved. So what we're going to do here is exactly to construct the gravitational dual of this lattice. Now, why is the lattice important? You see, if you have no lattice, then most of the transport properties of your system at zero frequency are all infinite. Let me give an example, the electric conductivity, okay? If you have a translation invariant system that is relativistic, then you can boost your system, get a current, but do not apply an electric field. This means that the electric conductivity is infinite, okay? From the condensed matter physics side, it's easy to understand why this is the case. There's just nowhere where the charge carriers can dissipate their momentum if there's no lattice, okay? Furthermore, even if you have a perfect lattice with no impurities, you still have a DC conductivity, an infinite DC conductivity, just because of block waves, okay? So we want to remediate this and to build an holographic lattice at finite temperature. Okay, that's the aim. The aim is to build an holographic dual of a lattice at finite temperature using Einstein's gravity. So this is the plan of the talk. I hope I have time to cover all of this. We'll start with the simplest Lagrangian that exhibits the properties that we want. Then I'll explain how we decided to parameterize our lattice. And then I'll tell you what was the first challenge that we faced. Just showing the well-posedness of the equations that we're going to solve, it's a tough problem. Then I'm going to show you some of the results, the gravitational crystal, and I'm going to try to argue that as it stands up in point four, we cannot do much with it, okay? We have to do something a lot more complicated in order to learn something interesting, okay? And this leads me to the second challenge, which is a big challenge that we faced when we studied this solution. And I'll present the results. If you've been sleeping up till here, this is the place where you should wake up, okay? Because this is the if you want, the meat of the talk. And then I'll explain why we are very excited about this. okay? And then I'll present some extensions and perhaps two shy predictions of this model, okay? In the end, I'll end up with some conclusions and outlook. Good. So what we want to do is to construct a neutral lattice, okay? We have also generalized our work to include a proper ionic lattice, but for now, we want to include a neutral lattice. We want to have a finite charge density, so it means you need a Maxwell field, and we want to have a certain temperature, so we need a black hole. So a Lagrangian that exhibits all of these key ingredients is the scalar Einstein-Maxwell theory. Here it is a Lagrangian, there's this F, which is a Maxwell field strength, it's just the exterior derivative of A, and there's this neutral scalar field, okay, which sits here, and it has a simple potential. You can change the potential. In fact, you can embed this into M theory. You can do all sorts of things, okay? The potential I chosen was conveniently chosen for numerical purposes, but you can change it. You can do stuff to it. Now, I'm only going to focus on solutions that approach at the conformal boundary flat space. So I'm only going to consider solutions that live in the Poincaré patch of ADS, okay? And let me partially introduce the manifold. There's a time t, and there's two spatial directions which I'll label by x and y. Of course, because I'm doing holography, there's an additional coordinate that I have to specify, which is the holographic direction, which I'll label by z. Okay, good. What we're going to do is to introduce the lattice by turning on a source. The space is three dimension, so it's 1 + 2. Yes, you could do 1 + 3 as well. Yes, yes. We can do three-dimensional as well. And in fact, this is one of the predictions that I'm going to tell you in the end.
Maybe I can just ask a very simple question. How can a lattice still be conformally invariant?
You partially, because you introduce a scale, you partially break conformally invariant. No, by the end of the day, no. So we turn on a source for the scalar field, okay? This source, according to the ADS CFT, and if you work out the equations of motion associated with your scalar field, just appears at order z. And then the response is just a subleading term which appear at order z squared. All the other terms in this expansion of the boundary can be just determined as a function of these two. These are just integration constants, or functions, I should say in this case. The lattice is put in by hand. It's not that we have a system that we cool down and forms a lattice. That's not the case. We are going to force the lattice in the UV, okay? By explicitly putting here something that oscillates in space. And according to the ADS CFT, this first term here is just a source for an operator that is dual to phi, and the response is just the expectation value of this operator. So, yes?
So then besides the lattice, there is additional source for breaking the scalar field.
No, there are other sources, right? I mean,
if you turn on the non-normalizable component by S, then
there are, exactly, you could generate a lattice, for instance, by doing the chemical potential. I mean, as you shall see, there are many ways of generating the lattice, and the result that I'm about to present is completely universal. We have generated the lattice in a different way, and we still get the same results.
So is there any reason why you choose this phi field with this particular conformal weight?
No, it's just for numerical reasons. It's related with the mass of the scalar field. If you get other masses, you'll of course get other conformal weights, but they're irrational. They're square roots of stuff, and doing numerics with that, it's tricky. That's the only reason. There's nothing special about this, okay? Any more questions?
So this is two sources, this phi s and the phi r are periodic potential, basically.
Good. You're asking all the nice questions because that's exactly what I'm going to tell you just afterwards.
But why don't we have a first term? There's a
No. Good. Good.
Square term, but no constant term.
Good. Because if you solve the equations of motion for the scalar field at the boundary, that term is not allowed, okay? So if you want, these are the integration constants that you have in your equation of motion, okay? So you cannot give both. Once you give one, the other one is specified by regularity somewhere in the interior. So following your question, generic static source depends on x and y, okay? We're going to do here an assumption. We're going to put the lattice just in one direction, okay? We don't expect our results to change. But of course, it would be great if I could have some supercomputer access and actually do the full two-dimensional thing, okay? But honestly, we really don't expect anything to change. But of course, it would be nice to check.
But it's not a spatial lattice. What you're doing, you're turning on a coupling, and that coupling takes values which depends on
the X.
Right.
Yeah,
I guess that's from condensed matter that is.
But you could do, for instance, you could turn on the oscillations in the chemical potential, right?
Okay.
And that would generate chunks of positive charge, negative charge, positive charge. And we did that. And the result is the same. Mm-hmm. OK? I'll come back to that in the end. So this is the way that we chose to parameterize our lattice. There's an amplitude, which is a naught. And there's a certain lattice spacing, which I parameterize by k naught. OK? Good. Finite temperature is introduced in the bulk by considering deep down in the IR a black hole. Finite charge means that we need a Maxwell field with a finite chemical potential. And this generic solution depends on these ratios. Okay, so the solution has a moduli space that is three-dimensional. Good. So what is the line element that I can write down, the most general line element that is compatible with the symmetries and with what we want? Okay, I promise this is the only complicated expression that I'm going to write in this talk. Here it is. This is the line element. It depends on 7 arbitrary functions, which I have to determine by solving the nonlinear Einstein's equations. Okay? Let me go through this more or less carefully. So there's these Qs, they parameterize a metric. There's these factors of 1 minus z sitting around here, which ensure that we have an horizon located at z equals 1. That's what these factors do. And there's this p here, which parameterizes the temperature of your solution. Okay? In fact, there's a simple relation between the temperature and this parameter, mu. Okay? Good. The question is then, I'm telling you that I'm inputting this into the Einstein equations. How the heck do I solve them? I mean, they're highly nonlinear. I have to tell you what I did. In fact, if I look at this line element, I have not even chosen a gauge. Okay? So it seems that we have too many functions for the problem that we have to solve, because I've not specified my gauge yet. Okay? In fact, it's even a little bit worse than that. This is not a well-defined problem if I don't pick a gauge, because the Einstein equations do not have a definite character unless you pick a gauge. And once you pick a gauge, it's not obvious that it has the character that you want in the PDE sense. So what we are going to do is to use a trick that was proposed by Toby Wiseman. We're going to deform the Einstein equations. We're going to add a new term to the Einstein equations and transform it into the so-called Einstein-Dirac equations. Okay? So I introduced this new vector field there. Good. This vector field can be arbitrary. And this is an equation that is well studied in the mathematical literature. For the purposes of this talk, I'm going to pick a vector field that is given by the difference of two connections, two Christoffel connections to be precise. And one is associated with the metric that I want to find, and the other one is associated with the reference metric. This reference metric, I get to pick. It's up to me to choose. The only conditions, it must have the same asymptotic structure and the same causal structure as the metric I want to find. For instance, for the case that I have here, the reference metric just has all of these variables equal to 1. Okay? Good. There's a huge payoff. This operator, this differential operator, if you want, is manifestly elliptic. So it means that my problem is well defined. Okay. Of course, it seems I'm cheating, because instead of solving the Einstein equations, I'm actually solving this guy. So I have to ensure that when this guy is equal to 0, that the Dirac equation is equal to 0, in fact, I'm on a solution of the Einstein equations. And the way that you do that is to give boundary conditions for this vector field chi that ensure that when you run a solution, chi is equal to 0. Okay. This is usually done by choosing suitable boundary conditions. And in simple examples, one can actually show this equivalence. Whenever GH is equal to 0, then G has to be 0. In some simple examples, this is also called Einstein-Dirac flow. In practice, we trust ellipticity. If the system is elliptic, it means that the solution is locally unique. And so we should be able to differentiate between something that has chi different from 0, which is a so-called Ricci soliton, and the solution with chi different from 0, okay, with chi equal to 0. Also, usually when I present this, people ask me, well, you did all of this fuss about the gauge, so what the heck defines the gauge? Well, the gauge is just defined by this guy being 0. So it's a generalization of the harmonic gauge, if you want. Okay? Good. Then how do we solve the PDEs? Well, those of you who know me already know the answer to that. We use pseudo-spectral collocation methods. And once we have discretized our equations, we just solve a bunch of algebraic equations using the Newton method. Okay, that's easy. The domain is automatically a square domain because x is a periodic variable and z is the holographic direction. And in the x direction, because it's periodic, we use the Fourier points. In the holographic direction, we use the so-called Chebyshev-Gauss-Lobato collocation points. Okay, why am I saying this? All solutions that we have presented in our paper have this Dirac vector zero to machine precision. Okay, just to make sure that we're really on a solution of the Einstein equations. And if you are using these methods, we better get exponential convergence. Okay, what does this mean? This means that if I calculate the quantity, for instance, the charge contained inside a unit, an integration domain, and if I calculate it for several values of my grid parameters, I better find a straight line in a log-log plot that shows exponential convergence. Here is an example. So you see this beautiful straight line. So it means that our method is working very well. Why am I bothering with this? This shows that our numerical method is really robust, and more importantly, that our background solution is very, very accurately determined. Keep this in mind. Out of these two slides, just keep this in mind. We have very good control on the numerics of this solution. It will be important later. So let me show you some results. Okay? For this case, I chose a wave number of 2, an amplitude of 1, a chemical potential I've set to 1.4. So the chemical potential you can see as more or less setting the Fermi energy. So this is a realistic value, T over mu of 0.1. Here are the results that we get. So let me just go through this carefully. In all three-dimensional plots that I'm going to show in this talk, this axis is always the boundary direction, and it's periodic. And this one is always the holographic direction. This is the boundary. And that plane back there is just the horizon. OK?
So this, what is the vertical axis of the first left?
Good. This is one of the off-diagonal elements of the metric. You will see why I put this here. Right now, it's just a metric function. Okay. On the right-hand side, we have the scalar field. In fact, it's not the scalar field. Really, it's a factorized version of the scalar field. There's a power of z to converge from one to the other. Why am I bothering to show you this? The first thing that you see is that even though the source is of order 1, which is what this shows here, the back correction on the metric is tiny. This is because the scalar field or the stress energy tensor that sources the metric is quadratic in the scalar field. Okay? That's the first point. Secondly, from the perspective of gravity, it seems that the lattice has half the size. Okay? So there's 4 peaks here, whereas here there's only 2. This is the fact, again, that the metric is quadratic in the scalar field. Okay? Now, but there's something curious about this plot that might change a little bit of what we mean by a relevant operator. Okay? This plot goes towards small values as you go deep in the IR. Now, why is this weird? Let me translate this into phi. Okay, now we're going to look at phi. We're going to multiply this by z. This is the plot, and phi is not a monotonic function of z. It first grows and then decreases towards the horizon. Now, this looks weird because we have turned on a relevant operator on the boundary, and it still seems that deep in the IR, the solution is going down, not up, as you'd expect for a relevant operator in the IR. Okay? In fact, one can show that if the gradients are large enough, if k naught squared is bigger than 2, then this scalar field at the horizon decreases as the temperature decreases. This is completely counterintuitive. If you think about relevant operators, you'd expect something to go the other way around. As long as the gradients are large enough, and this should show up in
Is it related to the null-Hare theorem that the horizon of the black hole?
I'm glad you asked that question. I was not going to touch this subject. This is surprising because of the null-Hare theorem. Because you'd expect what? You would expect that at least at zero temperature, you couldn't find any hairy black hole. This is not really a hairy black hole because I'm turning on a source for the operator. And hairy black holes, they preserve all of the conformal invariants at the boundary, so you turn on no source. Okay. But you would not expect to find extremal solutions with an untrivial scalar field. Okay? So even though we have a boundary source, the spatial gradients are enough to stabilize the IR. That's what this means. Okay. Indeed, there are smooth finite density lattices at zero temperature, as long as their spatial gradients are large enough. Now, to me, this was a surprise.
Is zero temperature extremal black hole? Or
yes,
no?
you can have two things. One is not having a black hole at all, just pure EDS, down in the Poincaré patch, and I can still find your lattice. Actually, in that case, I can find you the lattice analytically.
Okay, and you can show that the Poincaré horizon doesn't get
smooth. Smooth. It's smooth. The scalar field
and
actually.
And I can continue to the analog of global finite problems.
You can get in the analog of global coordinates.
So I can get out of the Poincaré patch, and I don't have some subtle. There are other cases. There are singularities hiding there that aren't necessarily out.
No, there's no singularities in this case. Okay. We can show it smooth for many things. For instance, even for strings that get close to the Poincaré horizon, there's no infinite excitation or tidal forces. Showing up there. I've not made this construction in global EDS, if that's what you're asking. And I don't know if that would work.
Well, okay.
So in global EDS, you'd have to prove that you could cross the Poincaré horizon in a smooth way.
Yeah.
And that I've not shown.
Okay, we can talk about
it. This is like because the average of cosine is zero?
You guys are asking all the right questions. It's precisely because of that. It's because the average of the relevant operator that I turned on is zero. That's why this happens. But this seems a little bit counterintuitive, right? But because the average is zero, I can have large enough gradients to stabilize the IR, even at zero temperature. There's something else we can calculate, which is basically what is the effect of this lattice on the charge density, okay? Now, it so happens that this is very tiny. Look at these numbers. They're very, very tiny. Even though this guy oscillates with order one, the dependence in the spatial, in the charge density is very, very tiny, okay? It oscillates with the double of the wave number of the lattice precisely because the charge density only fills the lattice through gravity. There's no direct coupling between the scalar field and the lattice, okay? On the right-hand side, I have a Fourier decomposition of this guy, and the fact that you see straight lines here in a log plot just means that we are really in a linear regime from the perspective of this lattice. That's the only thing I want you to take from this slide, that we are in a linear regime from the perspective of the charge density. Okay? Good. So we have this lattice. What can we do with it? Well, one obvious thing that we could do is to study, say, band gaps. But it's obvious that you need to have band gaps just because the solution is periodic. We wouldn't learn much with it. Okay? We have done that as a test of our codes, and we see band gaps. I didn't even bother to show it here. But really what we want to do, in order to say something interesting and perhaps universal, is to study the lattice transport properties. That's really what we want to do, okay? Now the easiest thing to compute is electric conductivity, which basically measures how a certain material reacts when you impose an electric field. That's the easiest thing to compute. The problem is that according to the EDS-CFT dictionary, the calculation of this, which involves determining some Green's functions, maps into a classical perturbation about the lattice that we have just created with some prescribed boundary conditions. This means that I have to perturb the numerical solution I have just created, or else I cannot say anything interesting. So I have to do numerics on the top of numerics. So I'm going to change a little bit gears here, so this is a time I think suitable time to ask if anybody has any questions.
This may be naive. It seems a bit surprising that because it's average to zero, it's regulated IR, because this is like what you expect if you have some linear behavior, but once you have non-linear behavior.
It still happens. Still happens. And I can actually show you analytically in that case. I can even write down in the board if you want almost the expression for that lattice.
No, I'm not.
No. Sure. I agree with you.
If I do that, this would happen, though, after 10 milligrams.
I mean, it's even worse than that, actually. You can actually put a Gaussian field and ask what is the deep IR. And if the Gaussian is too large, then there's a singularity. But if it's not too large, it still hangs on there. So sometimes you don't even need to average to zero. And so you can study phase transitions according to the size of the impurity if you want that you put on the boundary. So this seems to be something that people have not noticed in the literature, and we really don't understand why. But we can talk more about it later if you want. Okay, so what we're going to do now is to take a deep breath and dive into a perturbation theory of a numerical solution, okay? So let me set up the problem. What we want to do is to perturb the solution that we have just created. So you're going to take a metric, set it to be the background. Background quantities will be indicated by a hat. And then we perturb it in this way, where epsilon is small. And you are only going to consider infinitesimal perturbations about our lattice, okay? Now, why am I making all of this fuss? After all, I've just constructed a nonlinear solution. Why is it complicated to construct a linear solution? Okay. The problem is that in order to calculate a Green's function, I have to include time dependence in my problem. Of course, because the background is translation invariant in time, this means that I can Fourier decompose my metric perturbation in time and get rid of that time dependence. But I pay a price. The price I pay is that I have a lot more metric functions to deal with. In fact, instead of solving 7 PDEs, I have to solve 11 PDEs. That's where the big problem lies, okay? And that's what makes this problem extremely hard. And it doesn't stop there. Because we have to do numerics on the top of numerics, it better be that our background lattice is very, very accurately determined. But I just showed you that that's the case. That's what this linear behavior in the convergence shows, is that we have our numerical lattice under very good control. And in fact, you can only achieve this if you use something like Chebyshev polynomials and so on. Now, there's another problem which people are facing simulations in ADS, and it's the fact that if you demand normalizability for your metric perturbations, it means that the first term that can appear in your metric perturbation is basically the stress energy tensor. And that term appears at order z to the cube in 4 dimensions. And if you are in higher dimension, this number increases, okay? However, we are going to impose an electric field on the boundary. That is done by choosing a perturbation for my Maxwell field that is order 1 on the boundary. So it's not suppressed by any power of z, because I just the source that I put there. And this means that there's a huge hierarchy between these two terms, okay? Which means that without using spectral methods, we couldn't have done this. There's a huge hierarchy. We have done this calculation in 5 and in 6 dimensions, and the hierarchy is even worse. So without using these spectral methods, there's no hope of doing this. At least that's my opinion. So once you have Fourier decomposed your modes, then this becomes more or less an elliptic problem, and you have to define again boundary conditions. That's the easy part. So for the scalar field, we are going to impose that it vanishes on the boundary. This means that we are not changing our lattice in the UV. There are still phonons floating around, EIR, but in the UV, we are fixing our metric, our lattice, okay? Also, the metric will be normalizable. So this means that we are not imposing, say, differences in temperature on the boundary. So we're keeping the metric finite. And we are going to choose the gauge field to have this form, just a d by dx component turned on, which means that we have an electric field on the boundary, okay? So to go from here to the electric field, we just take the d of this. And this is an electric field that oscillates in time. And we're not going to change the chemical potential. So the chemical potential is a constant. At at the boundary or at the horizon, we are just going to impose ingoing boundary conditions, which just means basically that our perturbations should cross the future event horizon with no problem, even though they're singular in the past event horizon. So this breaks time reversal, but it's normal. It's what is adapted to time evolution. Now, this is not the end of our problems. The biggest problem is not even solving these 11 PDEs. That's tough, but we can do it. The biggest problem is that if you look at the equations that result from these linear perturbations, they're actually invariant under this set of transformations, where chi is an arbitrary function and this beta is an arbitrary vector. What do these represent? Well, the first set of transformations is just the U1 of electromagnetism. The second one is just diffeomorphism invariance, okay? And we have to fix this redundancy. The way that we are going to do this, of course, is by picking a gauge for the linear perturbations. And that's what we have done here. We have chosen the Lorentz gauge and the Donder gauge. Now, at this point, you should ask me, why haven't you used the Deterk method? Because after all, you don't have to choose any gauge there. But you see that the Deterk only works, and you can show this, if the system that you're looking at is stationary at most. Here, there's time dependence floating around. And so this Deterk vector that we introduced in order to solve the equation would very likely be non-trivial, be non-zero. Okay, so we cannot do that. You could use the generalized harmonic gauge and so on and so forth, but we have not done. Also, as another point, perhaps a little bit technical, you can always achieve these gauges because these are wave-like operators for the gauge parameter. This is a theorem. You can always do this. Okay, after you solve the PDEs, you compute the conductivity just by taking a derivative in the radial direction of the field that you impose on the boundary and dividing by the electric field. The electric field is just given by this quantity. Okay? Good. So now we've got rid of all the technical details. If you want to talk more about these technical details, which I doubt you do, you can ask me in person. Results. Good. So let me show you the typical plot that we get out of our simulations, okay? The top plot is for small frequency. The bottom plot is for large frequency, for the same temperature, the same amplitude, and so on and so forth, okay? Now, the only thing I want you to notice from these plots, apart from the fact that they're pretty, is that everything at the horizon is absolutely smooth, which seems a little bit strange because I just told you that I have ingoing boundary conditions. So it seems that I should have some infinite number of oscillations if I'm working in these static coordinates. However, in order for spectral methods to work, you have to remove this singular behavior. Okay? And so we work with variables in our numerics that are completely smooth across the horizon. Okay? So what I'm going to show you now is the conductivity that we would have obtained if we did the calculation on the Riesz-Nostrum black hole. Okay? So translation invariant. So amplitude is equal to zero. Let's see what the conductivity shows. Okay, so this is the part where the results start showing up. This result is already known for a very, very long time. So on the horizontal axis, I have the frequency normalized to the temperature. On this side, I have the real part of the conductivity. And on this side, I have the imaginary part of the conductivity. Okay, the first thing is that the conductivity goes to a constant for very large frequency. This is just a consequence that the conductivity in 2 plus 1 dimensions is a dimensional. And the conductivity as you go towards small frequencies as a pole that goes as 1 over omega. Okay? When you see a pole in the conductivity in the imaginary part, you can use the Kronig-Kramer relation to establish that there's a Dirac delta function that is hiding there. Okay? Of course, numerically, we cannot see this. But we know that there's a Dirac delta function there. And this is just a consequence. This is not a superconductor. This is just a consequence of what I just told you. This system is translation invariant, it's boost invariant. So I can get a current by applying a boost, okay? Without ever applying an electric field. So the DC conductivity must be infinite, and that's exactly what we find here. So there's nothing mysterious about this. What we hope is that once we introduce the lattice, this Dirac delta function gets resolved, okay? And we hope that this will tell us what was hiding there once we introduce the lattice. So what I'm going to do next is to show you the same plot, but now with the lattice. And to guide the eye, I will keep these lines, okay? This is what we got, so just look at this one. So we see that the imaginary part goes up, but then starts going towards zero. And we see that the conductivity no longer has a Dirac delta function. In the next plot, this will be more clear, but it goes to a finite value. So the Dirac delta function is resolved. There's no longer a Dirac delta function because we've broken translational symmetry. Okay. At large frequency, basically, our probes do not see the lattice, and that's why these curves coincide for large frequency. Okay. Good. So what we're going to do next is to zoom in certain regions of these plots. First, we are going to zoom for small frequency. Okay? Let us do that. we find that the conductivity is finite, the real part, and that the imaginary part goes to zero. And here I've chosen a range of omega over t about 0 and 0.8. Okay? Note that this has to go to zero. In fact, this has to be odd. I can show this, that unitarity implies this. Now, what is surprising about these curves is that they fit to a very, very simple model. They obey a Drude-like relation. Okay? This means that if I take this expression, I take the real part, and I do a fit here, I get two numbers, the relaxation time, which is the time in collisions of electrons in this simple model, and this constant k. Okay? Then I do the same fit on the imaginary part. And these two sets of numbers agree with each other with 0.1%. So in this region, they're really obeying a Drude-like behavior. This is great because this tells us a way of extracting the DC conductivity or resistivity, which is the inverse of the conductivity, just by knowing what k tau is. And then you take the inverse. Okay? Now, why is this surprising? Well, if you look at the 101 solid state physics, the Drude peak expression is one of the first ones that comes out. It's really easy to deduce. You only need the second law of Newton mechanics and the notion of a particle in order to deduce this. But that's surprising because that's precisely what we don't have in a conformal field theory, okay? A notion of a particle. And still, it seems that even for small frequencies, there is a Drude-like behavior.
You're
absolutely right. What I'm saying is that we have no well-defined notion of a particle in this case.
Right.
And it still this comes out. No, at really, really high frequency, you're kind of above the lattice, right? That's why you don't see it. That's why these guys agree at large. At small frequency, you see the lattice. Right? You have small enough energy in order to see that your thing is not translation invariant.
Is it too difficult to compute spectral density for the
The full spectral density is difficult. Okay. More questions? Okay.
How do you know that these does not depend on the dimension of your operator?
That this guy doesn't depend. Good. Very, very good question. Thank you for asking. We've tried another scalar field with a completely different mass and the same results hold. But this is not the exciting part. This is a curiosity. We have no idea why this happens. But it's not the really, really exciting part. And thank you for pointing out. We don't have a notion of a well-defined particle here.
Maybe you do.
Maybe one does, but it's not obvious. Yeah, but it's not right. But it's not obvious what it is. Okay. So what we can do with this is to do the following. For several temperatures, okay, we can extract the resistivity, and for several values of k naught, and then we can plot them. Okay. This is what we get. This looks like a mess. So on the horizontal axis we have the temperature. On the vertical axis, we have the resistivity, and each color labels a certain lattice size, if you want. Now, this was extremely disappointing when we saw this, because the type of materials that we hope we can give some insight into are the cuprates, which are non-Fermi liquid materials, which exhibit a power law behavior. It's actually linear with the temperature, really down to very small resistivity, which we don't see here. Okay, because it depends on the lattice size. In the beginning, we were really worried about this, or we were not worried. I mean, we see this as an empirical data. We throw the dice and you see what you get. But now we're not so worried any longer. And you can ask me about this later, if you want. Now, what is amazing about this is that this looks a mess, right? All lines cross, and it seems to be no pattern. But thank goodness, Sean Arnold and Diego Hoffman decided to study the lattice effects once you have a very tiny perturbation in your charge density. They used the memory function formalism, which is a formalism that you can apply to conformal field theories. to extract what the resistivity should be for very small temperatures. Okay? And they did this in very, very general grounds. What is remarkable is that if we take these exact same quantities and divide by their prediction for small frequency, they organize themselves. They get to be more or less constants. And look at this awful behavior close to t equals zero. It's nested square roots. Okay? And still, our numerics is capable of capturing all of that. So it seems that we are recovering their result. It's in agreement with this paper, which I highly recommend you to read. It's a beautiful paper. Okay, but none of this is exciting. Okay? So the next part is the part where we see that we have really something going on here. What we did was the following. Now we know the behavior close to frequency equal to zero. We can extract the relaxation time. Okay? Then we're going to look at the behavior just after that chunk of space. Okay? This behavior falls into this range. Omega tau is in between 2 and 8. Okay? It's a factor of 2. And we see that the absolute value of the conductivity has a power law behavior with a certain exponent, minus 2/3. Okay? Furthermore, the argument of the conductivity, it's roughly constant in about 65 degrees. Okay? Now, we have done this calculation for many, and when I mean many, it's really many values of the lattice size, many values of the amplitude, and many values of the temperature. Okay? What I'm going to do next is to do a plot of all that data in a log-log plot. If this power law behavior is universal, they have to be all parallel in that plot. Okay? Look at this. Between 2 and 8, they're all parallel. So this result, it also if you change the temperature. This is changing the lattice size. This is changing the temperature. So we're recovering an abnormal behavior of the conductivity in a certain range between 2 and 8. Okay? And this abnormal exponent, it's always minus 2/3. It seems to be completely universal. Of course, this is numerics. So we have tried many, but this doesn't say anything. To do this properly, we have to do match asymptotic expansion. We have to do things analytically, and we currently are doing that. So the message to take home here is that there's this exponent, which is minus 2/3 in this range between omega tau of 2 and 8. But why are we excited about this? Well, we're excited about this because people have measured this in cuprates. They have measured the conductivity as a function of the frequency. And guess what? They find the precise same exponent, minus 2/3. So without any fine-tuning in our model, we get the same exponent in the same range, okay? And the same phase, also around 65, without any fine-tuning. Now, the really nice part, at least in my opinion, is that there seems to be no consensual explanation. There are some explanations that were put forward, but none of which seems to be very consensual within standard condensed matter physics. I think it's fair to say this. But there are condensed matter physicists in the room. You should correct me and say you're wrong. Okay? But all I'm saying, I'm not saying that there's no explanation at all. I'm just saying that it's definitely not consensual. If you talk with people like Subir Sachdev, they say that people basically don't understand this whatsoever. Okay? And in our model, that's what comes out for free. Okay? So we can do some speculation now. So we have generated ionic lattice with a boundary varying chemical potential.
So there is not a single method, regular method, conventional, which produces the same results.
No. That I can tell you with a straight face. Yes.
So using a method, is suppose you have a two-scalar field, you get a 65 degree.
With two-scalar fields, I don't know.
So you have one model, so you have one results.
No.
So whether there's a variation model, so you always get something.
Good. Perfect. So I have generated a different lattice. I got rid of the scalar field.
Okay.
No scalar field. And I just put the boundary chemical potential that is varying.
Okay.
And I get the same mid-infrared behavior. again, minus 2/3. So it doesn't seem that it's too dependent of whatever we put on the UV. Okay?
Okay.
Now, we have performed our calculation as well in 5 dimensions, which is supposed to be dual to a would-be cuprate in 3 space dimensions, exactly what you were asking. And we also find a universal behavior, but with a different power law, minus 0.86. So here we can make a really tiny shy prediction. If you find a 3-dimensional cuprate, and we're predicting that you should find this exponent. If this has anything to do with the real world, okay? We don't know. In fact, we don't even know why this number minus 2/3 comes about yet. We have no idea why this number is so universal. But in 5 dimensions, the behavior is still universal, and this number changes to minus 0.86. Okay. Furthermore, we have calculated another transport coefficient of this material, which is the so-called thermoelectric coefficient. So it tells you how much heat is transferred in the material when you apply an electric field. Okay, that's what this says. And we find a different exponent of minus 0.8. So we got very excited about this because we're, you know, both Gary, myself, and David Tong, we do theory. So we thought, aha, we're going to tell our experimentalist friends, and I'm sure they can measure this, the thermoelectric conductivity in cuprates, because everybody knows everything about cuprates except that they can't explain. That's wrong. So we talked with our Cambridge experimentalist friends, and they tell us, you know, this is extremely hard to measure. In fact, while we were having that conversation, they thought we were talking about the DC thermoelectric conductivity, and then we said, well, no, it's not the DC, it's the AC, and most of them didn't even know what that was. That's how obscure this quantity is. But these basically are our predictions. 3-dimensional cuprate, we should measure minus 0.86, and if you could measure the thermoelectric conductivity, you would measure minus 0.8. Okay? So I come to the conclusions of my talk. We have created an holographic dual of a lattice, a gravitational crystal. We have calculated its transport properties, and our results seem to bear a striking resemblance with the behavior seen in cuprates. We're not claiming that we know why, it just seems the case. Things to do. Well, we would like to create a superconducting lattice. We have done that already. That turns out to be very easy. You can see superconductivity in a lattice. What we have not checked, it's a huge test of the superconductor proposed by Gary Horowitz, Herzog, and Sean Hartnell, is to check that once we perturb it, there still remains an infinite conductivity in that case, that the infinite conductivity doesn't go away. We have not managed to do that yet because it's a lot harder to perturb that system. We'd like to extend this to a 2-dimensional lattice. For that, I need supercomputer access. So if anybody has one available, just let me know. And we would like to determine the phonon spectrum. Now, we know that we have phonons around because that just corresponds to some vibrations of the lattice in the IR. Okay? But just finding the phonon spectrum directly, it's very, very hard. We have to calculate the quasi-normal modes of this thing, which is a lot harder than what I've done. Okay? For that, we simply need a new idea. And now we're having just fine. And we're studying disorder, for instance. We're putting impurities, random impurities on the boundary. We're studying quasi-periodicity. That's some ongoing work with some of our Kenji friends. And this list could go on and on and on. So the main conclusion is, it seems that we have a framework that does 2 nice predictions for what the real world, in what the real world is concerned. And we're having a lot of fun doing it. So thank you.
I thought you are talking about 2D lattice. What do you mean by extending lattice
2D? Oh, no, because on the boundary, my lattice was just 1-dimensional. On the boundary. So there's more coordinates on the manifold at the boundary, but it's like waves instead of...
Oh, so you only have one single cosine.
Yes, yes. We can generalize this to more. We don't think this will change because we're studying the conductivity across that direction, which has the wiggles. So we don't expect this to change, but it would be great to check.
And another thing is that what if you turn law of the lattice of amplitude.
What
how
if,
the connectivity changes.
What if I, sorry?
Turn off the lattice modulation.
If I turn off, well, it goes to this. Okay, it goes to this one. There's a Dirac delta function here.
There's a A, that's okay.
That's a real part.
So
this graph.
Oh, so this is no, this
no
graph
lattice.
Is no lattice.
No lattice at all. And this, if you look at this, this immediately reminds you of something. This looks like graphene. It really looks like graphene, okay? Graphene does exactly this.
What's that dashed line?
The dashed line here is actually the real part of the, this is the conductivity, the dashed line.
I see.
So the conductivity as a Dirac delta function, then it starts at zero, or not at zero, at a certain number, goes up and then plateaus. And here it has a pole. That's why we know that there's a Dirac delta function hiding here. And then it goes to zero.
So if you turn on lattice, so what color is evolved? I mean, delta function.
Good. Continue to look at this plot. That's what happens. So we have a pole here.
Okay.
And now we turned on the lattice. And instead of diverging, now it goes back to zero.
Okay.
And here, this is finite.
Okay,
this doesn't look finite. Yeah, exactly. So in fact, it obeys precisely to a Drude-like expression on the nodes. And for cuprates, it's the same. It, if you go at small enough frequency, it also obeys to a Drude-like expression.
Can you go to the very last
conclusion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're talking about the phonon spectrum, right? So
yeah.
I don't understand how you can do it because your lattice is set up as a coupling, right? So is that you have in mind fluctuating non-normalizable component, but that's not
No. Good. I'm glad you asked that. So what we have in mind is fixing the lattice in the UV, but letting it vibrate in the IR. Right? You fix the lattice on the boundary and you let it vibrate.
But I read, okay, so sorry, I'm just, you know, I know that I read everything in ABS if you form the boundary, right? So if there are even an infrared expectation values of some operator, I still read it all from the boundary, right? There is a normalizable component and
right, so you would read off the non-normalizable component out of this.
So I guess okay,
sorry, you would read off the normalizable component out of this.
So you're saying do I have to fluctuate? So you're saying that I just fluctuate the...
Either I force it on the boundary, I do whatever I do to a lattice, I make it vibrate and see what happens. Or I fix the UV and I let the IR vibrate at it will. The issue is, if I do that, if I do the true calculation,
right, it looks like so it's more. It looks like you are doing as you said. So you have to do the forced dynamics of the coupling.
Yeah, either I choose to do that on the boundary, or I turn that thing off, and this gets mapped into a calculation of quasi-normal modes. But that's extremely hard.
No, but it's not a quasi-normal mode, because a quasi-normal mode does not change the
non-normalized. Good. So what I'm saying is, you can do this in two ways.
Okay.
One is by fixing the UV lattice at all, not make it wobble.
Right.
Okay, you fix it. And then that's a genuine quasi-normal mode.
Sure.
Right? The other thing is, you can make it vibrate at your will, and that's not a quasi-normal mode, and that you can do. The really tough one is to let it fixed in the UV and let it vibrate somewhere else. That's extremely difficult to do. I mean, at least for me.
So here you have this density, right? Density is constant. There's a finite density, not at the zero density.
Yes. So we have a finite chemical potential.
Can you say anything about the stability of these solutions?
That's this.
Well, that's a subset of that question.
But I can give you a cheap answer.
Okay.
At least when the lattice is small, it's stable. And that I can tell you immediately why, because there's no mode in ADS that is about to become tachyonic. This can be seen as small perturbations about ADS. You're done.
Okay. That's exactly a cheap answer.
I mean, the real thing, I have to sweat a lot more than what I'm willing to do right now, at least.
No. So in principle, you know exactly what you're doing with coupling. So So it would be interesting to see what is the corresponding potential in a dual field theory. All you have to do, you just integrate this.
Yeah, it would be interesting. We have not done it, but it would be interesting.
You said that this two field is very universal because you check it for many examples. But in this window, it's almost on the bound of the window. Because you have conformality, you can rescale the lattice size and the temperature together.
But we break conformality, right? By having a lattice. That was the point that Omar made right at the start.
Right, but then you say in different cases when you break it.
But it seems that this thing in the IR is stable to that. We've changed the amplitude, and we broke conformality in a different way. We've changed the nature of the lattice. We considered a chemical potential instead.
This window is measured in what units?
In units of the relaxation time, which is something that we extract when you look at the small, at the Drude-like part.
So this two was two and what units? Can you explain what are the boundaries of this window?
It's between 2 and 8, and the boundaries are basically before. So it's precisely this range that they do in the experiments. And it's between 2 and 8, and it's measured in the units of the relaxation time, which is something I extract when I look at the Drude expression. Basically, the Drude behavior finishes here, and then there's this fall off. And then right about here, the thing goes up again to the conformal value.
Yeah, in the high density, there's a spin 1/2 electron. And so one can imagine you can replace spin 1/2 like to say spin 1, say 3 species or 4 species electron, like a different isospin species.
Okay.
And maybe in the ADSFP, this can be done. I don't know whether this would change some number here.
Well, that's what we're trying to do when we change how we do the lattice. Okay.
But here is how many different Fermion species. Related to the question whether do you have Fermion here? I'm not familiar with this.
We do have them.
The spin 1/2 or spin 3/2 or what?
We do have them.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to say anything about it. And I'm going to tell you the reason why. So this model that I have, this Lagrangian that I had right at the start, we wrote it phenomenologically. We said, well, we want this, we want that, and we want that. Good. But then later I found out that you can actually embed this in supergravity, in 11-dimensional supergravity. Now, that doesn't tell you much. But we know that this 11-dimensional supergravity, the specific truncation that gives this, has something to do with the Bagger-Lambert theory, which basically has something to do with some Schoen-Simons theory in three dimensions, a CFT with the so it has something to do with that theory. Exactly how this map works, I don't know. Perhaps somebody in this room knows. I don't know. I mean, that's part of... We would like to actually say that this has something to do with the cuprates, but for that, we need to know better what we have here. And we don't. We just know the result.
But for sure, you don't have fundamentals in 1/2.
No. Fundamentally, you don't. You only have
especially
like...
Especially gravitational discrete. Sometimes they are confined. So
no, sure. You just have like bound states of this guy. I completely agree. You only have stuff in the adjoint. I completely agree.
But the question is that at the infrared, you have Fermi surface. Is Fermi surface of how many electrons, or how many fermion? How many species fermion? You know, usually if you know the size Fermi surface, you know, the number of species of fermion allow you to calculate heat aspect with different coefficients.
I don't know.
So presumably, this information should be important. Because at least from a mathematical point of view, that a number from a species may affect those critical properties, like a 65-degree angle, or may not, but usually they affect. But
I would like to answer to that question, but unfortunately, I don't know enough about the CFT to answer to that question.
How difficult would it be to put a gold fermion
Oh, it's terribly easy, but
so then you can answer some of
No, 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 I can answer some, but I cannot answer, actually it's a little bit more complicated than that, because as you will see soon in a paper that will come out by Nabil Iqbal and Tom Faulkner, what people have been arguing as being the Fermi surfaces in holography turns out to be incorrect. So it's not doing a probe field calculation that will answer this. You have to do something else. But it's something that whatever they can do, we can do here numerically. But the paper is still not out, and I don't want to speculate about it.
I think maybe the key point is on in the Huygensian material, it's a Fermi itself both carry current and the causing dissipation.
Right.
So here I wonder whether that's the case, or whether the current carrying object and the object which doing dissipation can be different. Because there's a lot of field here. Some other field we have like a mass which doing dissipation, and the current is currently carried by a subset of field.
That is very likely, because what is causing the dissipation is the black hole.
I see.
There's an horizon there, that's where stuff goes in.
Okay.
So that's very likely.
If that's the case, that's maybe one thing to interpret result as a there are some kind of a maximum excellence, there's some mass which causing so-called maximum dissipation. Then for any charge carrying object interact with the mass would all have the same property. That could be
right. That could be a possible
maybe something very universal.
Yeah, we hope yes, but to show that we're actually doing so this is numerical work, and right now we're doing a serious analytical work to really see if this exponent is completely universal or not. Until then, we can only hope it is.
Is there something that you could say, maybe putting impurities or making?
Yeah, we can do that.
So would you start seeing some kind of dissipation on a?
We hope to see something like a Mott insulator transition, for instance, by putting impurities on the boundary, and we're currently working on that. And also to look at quasi-periodic systems, just like they do in experiments. We're looking at that. It's really tough to simulate this numerically, but we're still looking at that with a collaborator of ours from Cambridge and the Garcia.
There are no further questions. Let's...